Great. Well, thanks for that introduction. Thanks to everyone for being here and for inviting me to speak about what I think to be a fairly crucial but often misunderstood aspect of socialist strategy, namely the rank and file strategy. Now, to start, like I said, it's an often misunderstood and there's a lot of sort of competing conceptions of what it is, but I just want to get a few audience reactions. I mean, we're going to have a lot of time for discussion, but a few audience reactions of what you think the rank and file strategy means. And then if you've read my Jacobin article and you sort of know what I'm about to say, maybe try to think about what you thought the rank and file strategy was before you read it. So let's just take a few comments here. When you hear rank and file strategy. Don?
In union context, it means the change comes from below. If you organize from below to push your union to the left, you don't rely on staffers to take it over.
The component of like simultaneously building union power and building like socialist organizational power.
Okay.
So merging those two together.
Let's take a couple more.
I don't know shit.
Well, you came to the right place.
Yeah, there's a conflict between the left and the right in trade unions, but there's also a conflict between the bureaucracy and workers organized at a shop floor level.
And then here?
I associate it with the idea that union leadership cannot be trusted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then did you have your hand up?
The fact that I think about how I heard it and why I was interested in this talk is I thought it was organizing by actual workers for the things that they want rather than relying on outsiders to tell us what we should want.
Okay. So these are all certainly parts of this component parts of the strategy. I think the one that I thought I would hear, but that maybe this group is more advanced than that, but oftentimes when we talk about the rank and file strategy, it really centers on this idea of socialists going and getting jobs in unionized shops. It's all these other things based on, I think there's a lot of analysis of the trade union bureaucracy and some of that, which we will get to. But a lot of it sort of derives from that idea that this is sort of what we're talking about when we're talking about the rank and file strategy. And I think the first thing that we need to understand about the rank and file strategy is that it is a strategy. And at the risk of, it's a kind of a basic point for seasoned organizers, but just to make sure that we're all on the same page, I really want to clarify, dot the I's, cross the T's on what a strategy is and how it differs from a tactic, because these two often get confused. So when we're talking about strategy, we're talking about a broad vision aimed at achieving an overarching goal. So something very big, broad, long-term. And tactics are specific actions that we take that are aimed at achieving that broader strategic vision. So in the current debates we've been having about the rank and file strategy, the strategy often gets treated as a tactic, so basically getting rank and file jobs, and not as a strategy. But as a strategy, the rank and file strategy is about far more than getting rank and file jobs. It's even about far more than the specific question of how socialists should relate to the labor movement. Really, the rank and file strategy is a strategic vision for how to build socialism, right? And a bit more specifically, it's about a particular aspect of our strategy for building socialism, which is this idea of the creation of the revolutionary working class agent. So we, as good Marxists, know that the working class is the force that is the only force in society that actually has the power to bring about socialism. In technical terms, academics sometimes refer to this as the problem of class formation. That's because it gets at this idea that this idea of the working class is not something that just sort of exists out there ready to spring into motion. It's something that has to be created, and it can take different shapes. And if anything from the history of the past 150 years or so has shown us, it's that this process of creation is a rather daunting challenge, to say the least, and can lead into some rather disturbing directions, or problematic directions. So basically, it's part of a broader strategy for building socialism. That's really the core strategic problem that the rank and file strategy is trying to solve, this problem of class formation. And so to do that, it relies on three different theories. So we're trying to solve this problem of class formation, and there's three different theories for how to solve this. Number one is that it has a specific theory of social change. Number two, it has a specific theory of consciousness. And number three is a theory of organization. So I'm just going to unpack these one by one and focusing on and sort of unpack them and talk a bit about how they differ from other theoretical perspectives that lead to different theories of social of how we should build socialism. So first, the theory of social change. The rank and file strategy is based on the idea that change does not come from convincing important people, or any people for that matter, just of better ideas through debate or discussion, but rather from concrete struggle. So it's unsurprisingly a materialist theory of social change. More specifically, it's a theory of social change that focuses on the workplace. And that's because at a material level, the workplace is the basic building block of capitalist production. It's the place where value is produced. It's the place where value is extracted from workers. Also, if we're thinking about at the strategic and ideological level, it's the place where workers have the most potential power due to capitalist reliance on their labor power. And it's also the place where individuals can be organized as workers. So where their identity as workers sort of comes to the fore, which is a broad-based identity that can potentially cut across a range of other competing identities like race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, etc. And this is a really key point to make, because what is the key way that bosses use to weaken workers? Well, it's to encourage workers to highlight those identities that divide them from each other, to see themselves as fundamentally different from one another. So organizing workers as workers does not seek to erase the differences that exist among workers, but rather helps them to see what they share in common. So that's the theory of social change. Next, related to the theory of social change, is the theory of consciousness. So again, we're talking about a materialist theory of consciousness. And that means that the way that most people make sense of the world is not some fully formed, coherent worldview, and doesn't come through discussion or reflections. And amongst some of us, it can, but for the most part, not. It's rather shaped by their material existence and their attempt to make sense of that material existence. And this understanding of consciousness is crucial for figuring out how social change happens. Because one thing that flows from this theory of consciousness is that people don't take action simply because they have a set of good ideas that they're presented with. Rather, they have to be convinced that this new set of good ideas is actually realistic and something that's achievable in some way. There has to be a plan. And usually this only happens in the context of struggle. So concrete struggle has the effect of reshaping people's sense of what might be possible and what they might be capable of. Just to give a concrete example from recent history, we can think about the West Virginia teachers. So the success of the 2018 strike really fundamentally changed in teachers' minds what they thought was acceptable in society, and also what they could change, what they could win. So the following year, when the state legislature tried to sneak through some legislation that would roll back parts of their 2018 victory, they were quite ready to quickly able to organize and turn out en masse for a one-day strike that put an end, or not put an end to, but stopped those cutbacks. So if we delve a bit into the theory, this is sort of what the socialist theorist Antonio Gramsci referred to as replacing so-called common sense with what he referred to as good sense. And basically what we're talking about is common sense is what you might think about as sort of the conventional wisdom of the period. So today that would be the idea that the world is too complex for workers to understand. They should leave it to bosses and experts to figure things out. Good sense for Gramsci is what we might think of, another term would be class consciousness. The idea that workers actually do have power as a collective and in fact have the ability to and the power to change the world. But to repeat, that shift from common sense to good sense can only come about through collective struggle. Okay, so that's the theory of consciousness. So we've got the theory of social change, theory of consciousness, and finally we've got the rank and file strategy is based in a particular theory of organization. This is something that some of you started getting at in your comments about what the rank and file strategy is about. That theory of organization starts with the fundamental contradiction that all worker organizations face, be they unions or political parties. And it starts with the fact that workers need collective organization to win anything. Their power only derives from their ability to band together and to disrupt business as usual. But durable, lasting organization requires stability. You can't constantly be refighting battles you've already won. There has to be a way to sort of consolidate and institutionalize your past victories. And so concretely speaking, what this does, this takes the form of contracts or agreements with opponents, be they bosses or political figures, as well as sort of formal organization in the form of staff, buildings, budgets, and so on. But once you're in the business of negotiating agreements, your opponents will only agree to those agreements if they believe two things. Number one, that your organization is capable of engaging in disruption that will disrupt their ability to continue their business as usual, such that settling with you is preferable to that disruption. And then number two, which is an important part, is that if they settle with you, that you can actually deliver on your end of the bargain. So for example, if you agree that the workers you represent will stop striking if the employer agrees to your terms, the employers will have to have reason to believe that those workers will actually stop striking, that there's actually a truce in the class war, so to speak. So there you see the fundamental contradiction that workers' organizations face. They need organization to disrupt and win, but they also need organization to control the disruptive capacity. So you need both disruption and stability in the same organization. And before I continue laying this out, it's worth pausing here to say that this is not a contradiction that workers' organizations can sidestep. Rejecting organization is not an option if we're serious about building durable movements for the long term. So we really have to grapple with this contradiction of stability and disruption. The problem that arises quite often in workers' organizations, as many in this room have personal experience with probably, is that as bargaining relationships get institutionalized, two things happen. First is the threat of disruption becomes more symbolic than real. Negotiations are ultimately based on workers' ability to strike or otherwise disrupt the social order, but both parties tend to prefer to negotiate rather than risk a test of actual strength. Second, the routinization of negotiation leads to increasing layers of organizational bureaucracy. The organization itself gets more resources, regular dues income, more assets like buildings, and headquarters, more staff to research, negotiate, and administer contracts and agreements. Now, amongst left circles, this is usually frowned upon as bureaucracy stifling worker militancy, and I'm not going to disagree with that. But I do want to point out here that there are some genuine upsides to bureaucracy, right? As socialists, we want to have big, powerful organizations that have the resources and capacity to mount a serious challenge to capital. But the problem is that as this process of bureaucratization takes hold, leaders and staff of workers' organizations can tend to mistake preserving the organization's staff and resources for furthering the organization's ends. So there's a conservatizing tendency within the organization, and here I'm using conservatizing in the sense of organizational preservation, not political conservatism, although sometimes obviously the two can go together. So this means that union leadership and staff can begin to mistake the organizational structures and leadership of the union or party for the organization itself. And it means that they can prioritize preserving that leadership and structure at the expense of advancing the organization's goals. So for example, a union might decide to back down from a strike that could possibly win their demands if it's successful, but if not successful, would risk bankrupting the union and getting its leadership thrown in jail. So as bargaining becomes more routinized and workers' organizations prioritize their organizational survival over achieving their organization's goals, the disruptive capacity upon which their power ultimately rests, so that power to sort of withdraw their labor, go on strike, can atrophy. So they might be able to coast along on inertia for a while, but there does come a point where employers or other opponents will test that underlying strength. And if atrophy has set in, the entire organization can come tumbling down. And this is certainly the history of what we've seen with US labor in recent decades. Now this theory, I imagine this theory of the conservatizing effect of union bureaucracy leading to union decline is familiar to many in this room. But the point I really want to emphasize here is that it's an effect that results from this contradictory position that workers' organizations find themselves in. It's not something that results from bad individuals or failed leadership. So it's not something that can necessarily be fixed simply by finding better leaders and better staff. At the same time, it's not something that can just be fixed by rejecting organization or by putting structures in place that can arbitrarily hamstring organizational leadership. Again, organization is essential for winning, for building power, and organization requires a degree of leadership. So we have to embrace this contradiction of worker organization and grapple with it head on. Now the key is to figure out what kinds of structures of accountability we can institute that can maintain this kind of fragile, unstable equilibrium of retaining the organization's disruptive capacity while also being able to consolidate and build on organizational victories. So that's why the rank and file strategy focuses so much on the rank and file, on the membership. Because that's the necessary complement and counterweight to union staff and leadership, which can help to maintain this delicate equilibrium. Okay, so those are the three key theories at the heart of the rank and file strategy. And in some way or another, all socialists who have fought to build socialism over the years have grappled with this core problem of class formation that I've been talking about, but they've approached it with many different theories. Another different approach than this sort of more materialist approach would be an idealist approach, which, concretely speaking, has manifested in efforts of what we could call sort of permeationism. By that, I'm talking about the idea that socialists sort of get jobs where they can be close to the leaders of worker organizations, and sort of through persuading them of better ideas, therefore help the unions develop better strategy. And that has obviously run into limitations due to the theory of organization I just laid out for you. Okay, so this general theory that I've talked about that's laid out the rank and file strategy so far has really informed the left has related to labor and working class organization for pretty much as long as the left and the working class have existed in any sort of meaningful sense, so going back to the 19th century. I think the left has long understood the problem of class formation to be one of its central strategic tasks. So, you know, you can go back to the work of the communists and the Trade Union Educational League on the docks in San Francisco, the Trotskyists in the Minneapolis coal yards, and so on and so forth. And this kind of strategy is sort of what's informing what they're trying to do in different ways. But what I'm talking about today, the rank and file strategy as we think of it today, is really also trying to apply these more general theories I've laid out for you to a specific historical context. And that's really the key thing I wanted us to think about today. That specific historical context starts with the sharp separation that exists today between socialists and the working class. So what do I mean by this? So basically what we're talking about is the idea that today's left is disproportionately, not entirely, but disproportionately made up of people who are not part of the working class and not part of, more specifically, not part of the labor movement. So that means that to the extent that working class struggle manifests itself, the existing left has often found itself on the outside looking in. The left may lend support by showing up at picket lines or raising money for strike funds, but by and large, they are not leading these struggles in any real sense. And I think many of us might take this for granted today, however much we may lament it, but it's vitally important to understand that this is a relatively novel position for the left to be in. But prior to the 1950s, I'm talking relatively novel, the question of how the left should relate to the working class wasn't really a question because, for the most part, the left was an integral part of the working class. If you look at left organizations prior to the new left of the 1960s, whether we're talking about the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, the IWW, the Knights of Labor, the Populists, we can go on, all these organizations were overwhelmingly made up of workers and farmers, because there was a large agrarian sector, obviously, prior to World War II. Of course, there were intellectuals, there were professors like me, there were some enlightened small business owners, there were some bourgeois class traders, a smattering of others hanging around. And some of these played, you know, important roles. I'm not trying to sort of diminish them. But the point is that they were a distinct minority component in left movements prior to the new left. So it's really only with the new left that we saw the emergence of a left that was not predominantly based in the working class. And like any process of class formation and reformation, this process of delinking the left and the working class did not just happen out of nowhere. Rather, it's the outcome of historic battles in the 1930s and 40s that end up severing the link between labor and the left. Now, obviously, the McCarthyite Red Scares that purged communists from the CIO were a big part of the story, but I don't have time to go into this right now, but if you dig into part of my book, I talk about how they were really, these McCarthyite Red Scares were really only able to have the effect that they did because of labor's prior incorporation into the Democratic Party's New Deal coalition in the 1930s. I'm not going to get into the details of that. If you want to know more, you can talk to me afterwards, raise it in the Q&A. I'm around all weekend. I'm happy to talk your ear off about the division between labor and the left. The key point for our purposes right now is that the new left of the 1960s was the first time that the left sort of found itself on the outside looking in when it came to the working class. Now, some at the time, and you still see this today, and you saw it over and over again in subsequent decades, really tried to sort of looked at this change and tried to argue that the post-war pacification of labor and this sort of delinking really meant that the working class could no longer be that revolutionary agent to build socialism. Instead, they made several attempts at sort of identifying some new social force that was going to be able to fill that role of the revolutionary agent. So for some, it was, you know, the students. It was others, it was the armed peasantry in the Third World. It was knowledge workers and the new class. Some had this idea of like this vague idea of like a popular bloc. Anyway, there's a lot of different approaches that we won't talk about today, but the point is that there were still some from a variety of left perspectives who continued to insist that it was only the working class that could be the agent that was capable of bringing about socialism. So for this group in the 1960s and into the 1970s, there was this huge problem, which is that how could we start to deal with this problem of creating the revolutionary working class agent if the left was largely cut off from the working class? So for them, they saw their key strategic task as socialists as rebuilding that link between the left and the working class. And so in this specific historical context, the rank and file strategy was an attempt at figuring out how to do that. And as we return to the problem again here in 2019, we're once again using the rank and file strategy to figure out how to do that. The key idea underlying the rank and file strategy is that the best way to reconnect, or the idea is that the best way to reconnect labor and the left is to rebuild a dense layer of respected workplace leaders, something that people have often referred to as a militant minority. Historically, labor and the left have both been strongest when there has been this kind of dynamic militant minority in place in the workplaces. Now, this is another term that gets thrown around a lot and I think is prone to some misinterpretations. I want to emphasize here that when I'm talking about the militant minority, I'm not talking about the loudest, most radical people on the job. I'm not even necessarily talking solely about committed, self-identified socialists. Rather, this militant minority is composed of what Jane McAlevey and others have called organic leaders. These are key individuals who are respected and trusted by their peers, who are able and willing to lead supermajorities of their coworkers to fight the boss. So they are the people who are capable of putting their workplaces in motion. Now, of course, it's important to emphasize here that socialists have played key roles in cultivating, organizing, and sometimes even leading these militant minority groupings, but always as part of broader coalitions. It's never something that some sort of self-identified group of socialists just do on their own. Now, this was a fairly organic sort of militant minority that existed in US workplaces through the World War II period, but the separation of labor and the left after World War II largely liquidated that sort of more organic militant minority, leaving more conservative, cautious union leadership in place. So proponents of the rank and file strategy set themselves the specific goal of rebuilding this militant minority by identifying, developing, and expanding the layer of workplace leaders who are primed to fight the boss and to build socialism, ultimately. So the idea was really to get workers used to fighting again, to take action to solve their problems collectively. Because if we go back to my theory of organization, as that sort of disruptive capacity atrophies, people just, you often hear in the labor movement, the strikes are like a muscle. You need to keep exercising it. So this was really a necessary first step towards increasing workers' sense of what's possible and what they could be capable of. So how did they do this? Now here's where we finally get to the question of tactics. How do we actually rebuild this militant minority? And rank and file strategy proponents have prioritized tactics that include, so what we talked about at the beginning, getting rank and file jobs in unionized workplaces. There's a strange term of industrialization, which is usually something that countries do, but among socialists, individuals did it. Or if you want to get really problematic, among some corners of the left, they refer to it as colonization. I'm not making that up. But anyways, part of the discussion of getting rank and file jobs, there was and is, of course, a lot of discussion and debate about identifying so-called strategic industries. So back in the 70s, this was auto, steel, transportation. Today, it's stuff like education, healthcare, transportation logistics, airline. There are certainly others. And I'm sure many of you have thoughts about this whole question of strategic industry, so I'll just save broader discussion of that for the discussion. Another tactic is obviously forming and joining reform caucuses to win leadership in and transform existing unions. So the best known of these in the US is obviously, or not obviously, but probably TDU, Teamsters for Democratic Union, the organization I used to work for before I became a sociologist. There's also the idea of building rank-and-file cross-union education and organizing networks. The best known of these would be something like Labor Notes. Now, as part of these union reform efforts, many rank-and-file members have run for elected leadership, some have won. When they have won, they've created openings for progressive and radical union staff that can sort of do some of the work of identifying and developing workplace leaders. But I think if we're talking about this sort of trying to embed oneself in the workplace, it's important to distinguish this version of what I'm talking about of the rank and file strategy and getting rank and file jobs from some other variants of what was in the 70s called the turn to industry that some groups pursued. Because other groups also focused on, we need our members to go get jobs in industry, but they really focused more on sort of explicit propagandizing in the workplace around socialist ideas with the goal of gaining adherence for their organization. So really, it really was more based in an idealist version of consciousness and social change, where they sort of thought that by talking to people about socialism and sort of convincing them of their brilliant ideas that they were going to build socialism in the workplace that way. So this approach that I'm talking about is not that. The rank and file strategy was not about being the loudest and angriest, most militant, and most lefty people in the union. Rather, it was about thinking hard about what was going to build this layer of trusted workplace-based fighters. So if we take a look back over the past 40, 50 years of this more specific, historically specific effort to implement a rank and file strategy, I think we have to be honest with ourselves in saying that the record has been mixed. Existing unions still have a lot of reforming to do. A lot of workers remain unorganized. The left still remains largely divorced from the working class. And if we're thinking more broadly, this working class revolutionary agent is still pretty far from ready for action. So we need to admit that. Still, despite the limits of what the rank and file strategy has accomplished so far, I think we can also say that it has played an essential role in many of the all too rare labor victories that we have seen in recent decades. So if we go back to the 1997 UPS strike, we can think about the 2016 Verizon strike, we can think about the teacher strikes in Chicago, in LA more recently. All of these examples, we look back at them and we see that workplace leadership has been key. And much of that workplace leadership was built thanks to the work of reform caucuses, reform union leadership, respected workplace militants, sort of doing that patient day-to-day work in the workplace. So we can say that the rank and file strategy can at least move the needle in the right direction compared to where we are. That being said, we have a long way to go and a lot of work to do. So assuming, make a big assumption here, but I'm assuming that most people in this room are here because you want to figure out how to make the rank and file strategy more of a reality in 2019 and beyond. I'm just going to close out my remarks with a few questions to the audience to maybe orient our discussion. So first, if the rank and file strategy makes sense for today, what do you think it should look like? Where should people get jobs? What are the strategic industries? What are your criteria for determining that? Second, what is the role of staff and elected leadership in developing and implementing a rank and file strategy, if at all? And then another big one that comes up a lot is how can the rank and file strategy help address the problem that 90% of US workers don't even have a union? Now, if you've been paying attention to the debates about the rank and file strategy in recent months, you've probably seen that a lot of the debate focuses on these first three questions I've laid out, or sets of questions. If and where socialists should get rank and file jobs, whether they should be union or non-union, what sectors, what about staff, what about relationship to the union leadership, what about the unorganized? But one of the key points I want to drive home here today that I think doesn't get enough play in the discussion is that it's important to recognize that coordinated efforts to encourage more socialists to take specific types of jobs is not the same thing as rebuilding the militant minority. It's certainly part of that building process. But ultimately, the goal must be to expand the ranks of workplace-based militants and socialists, not simply reallocating our existing set of socialists. So the question is, how do we move from redeploying our existing forces to expanding our army, if I can use a rather tortured military metaphor? It's a lot to chew on, but we have some time for discussion, so I thank you once again for taking the time to be here today, and I look forward to a dynamic conversation.